Good morning, everyone. Turn your Bibles over to the book of Job, and we'll get started there in just a second. It's good to see all of you. We're in our series that we've been working on the last couple of weeks, and since you're back from Thanksgiving and all of that, and are hopefully have moved past the coma that comes with that, I hope that maybe, this is my dream, that maybe when somebody got out the knife and the iron and started working with that, that you thought about these lessons, because that's been the analogy that we've been using over the last couple of weeks. Comes from Proverbs 27 and verse 17 that tells us, as iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. Or even some translations say, so a man sharpens the countenance of his friend. And we've been looking through these different facets that come from this analogy. We talked about communication in our first lesson. Iron has to meet iron. They have to kind of screech with one another and work each other into something better than themselves, which is what we talked about last week. Two pieces of similar material can impart a greater efficiency, a greater strength, a greater equipment to each other than one could on its own. And so, like hammer on a piece of metal there, like you see on this picture, it fashions it into something better. The hammer also is seasoned, if you will. It becomes better through the working with other irons. And so we looked at these analogies in the last couple of weeks, and we're going to finish off the series today with where our first lesson was titled Communication and our last lesson was titled Provision. We're going to title this lesson Provocation, in that when you've got two irons meeting each other, that the one is provoking the other to become something that it's resistant to be at first. You think of iron, it's hard, and we use it for tools because of that. But since it's hard and it's strong, you might say, strong materials are also very brittle and can break a whole lot easier. And so what you do is you heat up the metal so that it becomes a bit more malleable and can be refined, shaped, and honed into something more useful than just some ugly chunk of metal. So what we're going to be talking about today is, if the analogy as Proverbs presents it is as iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another, we're going to focus in on that last half especially this morning, and to see how it is that someone can sharpen the countenance of their friend, or what that even means. We've used a couple of examples earlier, countenance, like you remember in Genesis when God talks to Cain and his countenance fell. Countenance is like your manifestation of the world. Very simply, it's your face, what your face looks like, if you're happy or you're sad. Cain was upset, and so his countenance fell. But it's even more than that. It's your attitudes and your mindset and everything that comes to the forefront as you present yourself to the world. And so what we're going to do then is figure out how we can help each other to even provoke each other to be something more than just that raw part of steel or iron, but to be something useful in the tools of the master, to even provoke each other to do that. We've used the analogy before that just even like this picture, and I love the picture, it's got a lot of motion to it, some blur that's there as well. You've got this hammer just pounding on this piece of metal, and it's not really a gentle process all the time. Sometimes it's a little difficult. But when people are put into the forge of difficulty, if you will, it makes people think about what's really important, and it allows them to either stay strong and brittle and break, or to be a little bendable so that they can be more useful at the end of things. This word popped into my mind, and we'll be talking about this a lot during this lesson, of provocation. And this can be either a good thing or a bad thing. It's found a few places in various forms in the scripture. But I want to take you back even to history and other accounts as well to see how provocation can be a two-edged sword. It can be good, it can be bad. I remember when I was studying history during, you know, grade school, that when we got to the point of world history where we talked about World War I and then on to World War II, I remember the history book had just a couple of lines that said World War I was begun by the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand, and then it moved right on into the war, and I never understood for the longest time, why did that matter? What happened with that? Until just a couple of weeks ago, I started to listen to a podcast which was describing some of the history of the time. It's really very interesting that one person who to some people in the world at that time was called a provocateur could set in motion so many different things in the world. But from the assassin's point of view, the Archduke Franz Ferdinand was also a provocateur. And so everyone was provoking each other to move the world in such a drastic direction, which then was the elements that precipitated World War II, and then on into why the Middle East has some of the problems that it has, and why the world and its nations are arranged in the way that they are, all comes down to that moment, and probably a moment that preceded it also. By started in motion, this is what I'd like us to remember, moved in motion by provocateurs, for good or for ill. You think of some others as well. Right now, the Hong Kong protests, both sides, the Chinese government and the protesters, call each other the provocateurs. That's pretty interesting. You also look at a couple of years ago, Crimea and Russia, provocateur. That's where I first heard that word mentioned, you know, more than once within a month's span of time, is that provocateurs are interesting in that they do something which pokes or prods someone else to motion. And so you can automatically, with some of those examples, think how that could be kind of bad sometimes. Let's look to the scripture and see maybe some good examples, or maybe not good examples, but examples that brought about something that was good. If you look over in Acts chapter 17 and verse 16, you're probably familiar, depending on your translation, with a word that's used to describe Paul's mindset, that he was there in Athens at a place called the Areopagus or Mars Hill. It was the place where the pagans would come and debate with each other. It would look very much today like a TED Talk, where people are getting together and discussing ideas. In fact, Acts 17 says that they were there to talk about new things. And so when Paul was there and wandering around Athens, it says there that he notices several of the idols that are in town, and it says that his spirit was provoked within him. And so their idolatry provoked him. It moved him to some sort of motion. You can look at other places like Acts 26 and verse 14, where Paul is describing his interaction with Jesus on the road to Damascus. And you'll recall what Jesus says to Paul as Paul reiterates it to the audience. Jesus says that he is the one that Paul has been persecuting, and then he asks him a rhetorical question. It's difficult to kick against the goads, isn't it? A goad is a cattle prod. It's a poker. It's something that provokes some animal to move somewhere else. And so Paul was provoked in several different ways throughout his life to good ends. There's other places as well. Ecclesiastes chapter 12 and verse 11 says that these words of wisdom that have been compiled by the author are like goads which are wielded by one shepherd. And so those words of wisdom provoke you and me. They push you and me to do something that you and I might not be interested in at first blush. And so provocation then is an interesting term. It can be for both good or for ill. So let's go ahead and define the terms as we get ready to go into our lesson. Provocation, or more simply, provoke, is a verb. It means to stimulate or to give rise to. That is, a reaction or emotion, typically a strong or unwelcome one in someone. So a provocation, or someone who provokes another, does something which is uncomfortable, but yields or produces some sort of movement or motion. There's another word here we'll use as a synonym for our lesson. That word is stimulate. And stimulate is defined as to raise levels of physiological or nervous activity in their example, the body or any biological system. I remember when I was taking biology in school that one of our experiments was to get a snail out of one of the boxes that was over on the wall and literally poke it with a stick to see what was happening. It was very low-level, entry-level biology, and the snail, sibling, right? And so the snail is just crawling along my desk, and it says, just poke the snail and record what happens. So, of course, I poke the eye first, and the eye just goes, and it moves. And that's provocation. I have stimulated that snail. In fact, that was one of the terms they wanted us to use. I've stimulated that snail to do something other than what it was doing, something which I'm sure that snail thought very unwelcome. And so, with provocation then, it can feel upsetting and uncomfortable to the person who's experiencing it, and yet the Bible commands us to be involved in provoking each other. We'll talk more about that as we go through our lesson. Let's go into our main text, for now anyway, and that's in Job chapter 4. If you turn there, please. I asked the question of myself earlier, before this series even got started, how can a person sharpen another? What does that look like? And obviously, I'm not going to come at you with a piece of metal and try and shave pieces off of you. I want to figure out what the Bible's trying to get at. And of course, there's a metaphor to this. We're being described of how people interacting with each other can produce something better in one another, even through processes which might be somewhat difficult or uncomfortable, but not always. Here's an example of someone who's really a great example of someone who can sharpen another. And here's some of the answers that I came up with that I could find other things in Scripture concerning. Is that people can sharpen one another through many different methods, but one of them is through sharpening the thinking. And that you and I, as we have our thoughts, and these thoughts are compiled and stitched together through our experiences and through our upbringing and possibly some genetics as well, that we think a way about the world because of certain experiments that you and I have run in the world. We might not call them that, but we learned some things, we took some hard knocks, and so this is why I think this way. And that's hard to break out of unless some difficulty occurs. We talked about the forge of difficulty that allows us to be pliable, or it's just going to heat us and let us do what we're going to do anyway, which is break. So here's an example in Job of a person who helps another. Now, we're going to hear this through the words of Eliphaz, Job's friend, who, as Job will remark of all his friends later, sorry comforters are they all. God will remark earlier that none of them spoke accurately of God or of Job or how things were working. And yet, they all say some true things in their descriptions. And here's a bit of that in Job chapter 4 and verses 1 through 6. And here's the point that we're going to see, is that when circumstance makes it difficult to move, some provocation is needed. Look at Job's example. You know what happened to Job, how much he lost, what suffering he endured. And as he's trying to figure it out, his friends are trying to help him, they think, with this. And in verse 1 it says, "Then Eliphaz the Temanite answered, 'If one ventures a word with you, will you become impatient? But who can refrain from speaking? Behold, you have admonished many, and you have strengthened weak hands. Your words have helped the tottering to stand, and you have strengthened feeble knees.'" Now, in his editorial, he continues, "But now it," this difficulty, this advice, this admonition, whatever it is, "but now it has come to you, and you are impatient. It touches you, and you are dismayed. Is not your fear of God your confidence, and the integrity of your ways your hope?" Let's stop there for a second. What's interesting is that Eliphaz and all his friends think that Job has done some wrong, and Job has not done any wrong, at least until this point. And as Eliphaz is describing this, he says, look, when people had bad stuff happen to them, you came and you gave them a talking to. And in that talking to, you strengthened them, and you got them up on their feet, and you slapped them around a little bit so that they'd wake up and see that they could make it through this. But that's not always easy to receive. Look down again at verse 5. He says, "Now it's come to you, and you are impatient." Honestly, if that sort of admonition comes to me, it's not something I really want to hear right then. I'm going through a difficult time. I want to be able to move past this on my pace. But my friend comes in and wants to help sharpen my thinking on the world, how it works. So when circumstance makes it difficult, provocation is that thing that'll get us over that last step that you and I don't want to be involved in. Think about the example that Eliphaz uses, and look at maybe how that could have worked in Job's life as he went and talked with other folks. In verse 3, the first part of verse 3, we're told that Job went and admonished many people. An admonition can, again, be a kind of positive or negative, depending on where you're at and how you want to think about it. Admonition is typically some sort of rebuke, some sort of correction, a discipline, if you will, and so sometimes seems fairly painful, but an admonition can also just be a simple instruction in that here's the way that it works, and maybe I'm ready to receive that, and it's really easy to take. And so admonition can go both ways, but Job was involved in this all the time. Look also at the end of verse 3, it says, "And you have strengthened weak hands." You think about when circumstance is difficult, it's hard to do things, it's hard to get up in the morning, it's hard to get to work, and so my hands are feeble, I can't grab anything, I can't do anything. But in this communication that Job has with other people, their hands have been strengthened, they've been worked out, there's a difficulty that happens there. Go to the next verse, in verse 4, once more, "Your words have helped the tottering to stand. You've strengthened feeble knees." And so as Job is being told or reiterated to him what he's done, we get to see that all three of those things, admonition, strengthening hands, stabilizing knees, are all the same thing. I think it's a great way to describe what happens when a person sharpens the countenance of another. I know you're going through difficulty. And yet, sometimes a strong word can get me to pick myself up and move on with my life for the better. Let's look at another example, and this was read for us by Carlos a second ago in Hebrews chapter 12 and verses 11 through 13. Hebrews chapter 12 and verses 11 through 13. And I want to use, we've talked about this before, I want to use discipline in that word in its most general sense, in that discipline typically brings to mind punishment, grounding, spankings, whatever. But discipline isn't always that. Discipline is instruction in its most general basic sense. Sometimes it's painful. Sometimes it's easy. Here in this passage, the Hebrew author talks about the maybe more painful side. And it says there in verse 11, all discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful, but sorrowful. Yet to those who have been trained by it, afterward it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness. You got to go through a little bit of pain to learn something useful. It makes you better than what you were. If life were always easy and the lessons learned were done easily, everyone would be wise. But wisdom's a rarity, and we all, I think, recognize that. In verse 12, he continues, therefore, as we get ready to read this, think about what Eliphaz said about Job. Therefore, strengthen the hands that are weak and the knees that are feeble, and make straight paths for your feet, so that the limb which is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed. Healing and improvement and growth comes through difficulties, through the sharpening of one person to another. It's a person to communicate good, wise words to someone else. I think of an example. When I was growing up, I lived at the end of this really long dirt road, and there'd be lots of people that would drive through there really fast. And if you've ever lived on a dirt road or been on one before, there's the washboard effect that comes when people drive too fast. And it's just parts of your car are rattling off and everything like that. And so my dad and I would go out. We had a railroad tie, or not a tie, the iron, the piece of metal. And he'd welded two chains onto it and strapped it to the back of the truck. And we would drive that iron down the street to grade the road. And it was a lot of work. And I'd stand out behind the truck and shovel extra dirt out of the way as we were moving down this long stretch of road. But that work made it easier later on. And so when it says there, make straight paths for yourself, that's what comes to my mind, is do a little work now, and it'll be a whole lot easier later. And that pain, that admonition, that difficulty is just us being forged out into something that can be useful in the hands of the master. So discipline makes life easier, but it needs a little difficulty to do that. We could use other analogies. You know them. Maybe you've experienced them. Depression is helped through constant rethinking. Harvard has come out with several studies lately that says that antidepressants and things might help in a short term, but definitely not for long term, and that the only answer is a constant rethinking, a recarving of neural pathways to get someone to think about life differently than the state in which I find myself. You know that strength is improved through exercise, and the bodybuilders are always saying, pain is just, weakness leaving the body, is that there's this idea that you're growing by causing your muscles to break down a little bit at time to time. You know that recovery is increased through therapy. There's people who go through surgeries, maybe it's a hip surgery or knee surgery, some of you may have undergone. Nowadays, they're getting you up that day, and they're having you move around with the walker. That is important to your growth and to your well-being. You and I know this, we've experienced that. It's sometimes just difficult to get it into our heads when it's happening. Discipline makes life easier through difficulty. And because of that, as we've said, admonition is sometimes difficult to receive. In our context of Proverbs 27, which is where we find our iron sharpens iron proverb, there's a couple of other fun proverbs that are there. And by fun, there's one I found towards the end of the chapter that says, it basically along the lines of, hey, you may be good friends, but if you wake me up early in the morning, you're going to find that that's not wise. It's really funny. Look at it there at the end of the chapter. But in Proverbs 27, and if you look at verse 9, it says there that oil and perfume make the heart glad, so a man's counsel is sweet to his friend. And counsel, good advice, isn't always easy. If it were good advice, I would have come up with it, or if it were easy, I'd have come up with it on my own, and I'd have gone along with my own advice, but it's a good friend who tells me, maybe you're not going the right direction. Also in verse 22, in that same chapter, it says, though you pound a fool in a mortar with a pestle, along with crushed grain, yet his foolishness will not depart from him. Where I bring that passage up to is that there's two roles going on here in our lessons so far. There's a person who's receiving some sort of instruction, and there's a person who's dishing that out. And you and I are going to flip-flop at any given point in our lives. We might be the person that could admonish. We might be the person who needs the admonition. And so it's important, I think, to bring up verse 22 in that if you and I will stick to being fools and will just be so rigid on every single thing that we're not willing to bend in one slightest sense, we will shatter. But if we're willing to let our foolishness be, in a sense, beat out of us from this mortar and this pestle, if we go through some difficulty and are willing to learn from that, we are going to be wise, at least by the end of it. And that's a great and wonderful thing. So here's the first answer of how can a person sharpen another person? I think very simply in this, that they can sharpen each other through their thinking. When you're going through difficulty, it's easy to get in a rut of thinking one way all the time. Sometimes it's helpful to have an outside perspective that helps with that. Let's finish up with this point with this, something to take home, is that others are able to provoke an individual to sharpen their thinking and to affect change. We are able then to sharpen each other. Any one of us can do that with the other. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. But I want to talk about one other thing that we've seen elements of in the last several lessons, but really want to flesh out here in this lesson. That is that you and I can sharpen the doing. That if we're going to think a certain way, that our actions will follow. And then it's helpful to have somebody else, that other iron, be a good example of what it means to be an iron, what it means to be a person acting and doing God's will in the world. And show that to us so that I can look at them and go, hey, here's what I can do. My doing is refined. My activity, the motion that I was provoked to do, is now something better than what I was doing beforehand. Let's go over to Romans chapter 1 and verse 11. Romans chapter 1 and verse 11 to start with. The book of Romans is a book that adjusts the thinking. It really did for me when I first studied this. Romans scared me for a while. It's a big and it's a complicated book. I think the only one that scared me maybe more than that was Revelation. Interesting how they both start with R's. But as I was going into Romans, I was thinking, okay, let's let this work. And I'm not going to read any commentaries right now. I'm going to go verse by verse and figure out what's happening. And when you do that and don't just try and proof text or anything, it really all starts to come together. It doesn't mean it's not easy all the time, but it's got a flow and a process if I'm willing to bend. And so when the thinking is adjusted, a good example can stimulate other people to follow. Look at Paul's intro in this letter, Romans chapter 1 and verse 11. He says, "For I long to see you, to be in person, so that I may impart some spiritual gift to you, that you may be established." When we think spiritual gifts, for the most part, in my mind jumps the miraculous gifts and different things like that, but that's not what Paul says here, I don't think anyway. Look at the next line. He says, "That is," or in other words, more specifically, "that I may be encouraged together with you while among you, each of us, by the other's faith, both yours and mine. I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that I have often planned to come to you and have been prevented so far, so that I may obtain some fruit among you also, even as among the rest of the Gentiles." So Paul says, "I want to get to you, but in the meantime, I'll write this letter to you," and that's the next couple of verses from then on. But Paul's hoping to change their thinking by the letter to prepare them for when he shows up to sharpen their doing. Now, notice what he says again there. He brings up a couple of interesting points. And we could notice them by asking a couple of questions. How do you think, in verse 13, Paul would obtain some fruit among the Roman brethren? What does that look like? Obviously, they're not trees. He's not going to be pulling things off of them. Fruit, from a biblical standpoint, is action. It's the tasks that we do in the world that are moved by where our roots come from, rather. Jesus mentions that in John chapter 15 and 16 and 17 about fruit and vines and branches. And so when Paul says, "I want to obtain some fruit among you," what he's saying is, "I want to see you in action. I want to see what you're doing." And that comes from verse 12. If you'll back up a little bit, he says, "We could be encouraged by one another's faith." Now, faith is this kind of etheric concept. It's not something that you can look and say, "Oh, you know, there's where my faith was hiding in there." And yet faith comes into the world. It manifests itself through activity. James asks it very famously, "You show me your faith without works, and I'll show you my faith by my works." In other words, I can't see your faith unless I see that faith doing something in the world. That is to say, faith and works aren't equal, but works always comes when faith is present. And so when Paul says, I want to be encouraged together with you, there's this middle voice going on here. I want to encourage you, and I want you to encourage me. As he goes there, he says, by each other's faith, both yours and mine, we'll be able to sharpen each other's doing. We'll be better through the end of this if we can have this time to spend together. So this is, again, I think another reason why, or how, a person can sharpen another. Sharpen each other through their thinking, that I don't always think the right way, and I need somebody else to help me. And I don't always do the right thing, or I don't always do it as efficiently as I could, unless someone shows me. And so Paul wants to do that, and we can do that for each other also. Let's go down to Hebrews again. We're running through this main text in Hebrews as kind of a sub-thread to this lesson. And this is in Hebrews chapter 12. And starting in verse 14, Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 14. Here the Hebrew author shows us the result of being sharpened, whether it's by seeing an example of somebody's faith or being confronted about a way of thinking that maybe needs to change. And so when we talk about encouraging the faith of each other or being encouraged by the faith of each other, it's simply by just getting to work with each other. And that, again, getting to work makes things easier. So we've talked about this in kind of more general terms up to this point. Let's get them a little bit more specific and practical now. And we'll see, I think, an example here in Hebrews 12. We finished off, last time we were here, in verse 13, talking about how discipline can produce the fruit of righteousness, which is sown in peace. Now, if you look at verse 14, this is a conclusion now, or like how you do this. In verse 14, he says, pursue peace with all men, and the sanctification, or the holiness, without which no one will see the Lord. See to it that no one comes short of the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springing up causes trouble, and by it many be defiled, that there be no immoral or godless person like Esau, who sold his own birthright for a single meal. For you know that even afterwards, when he desired to inherit the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no place for repentance, though he sought for it with tears. Let's start at the end of that passage and back up through it, and so see some of the things that are going on. You recall Esau. He went out hunting. He came back and was super hungry. He was like, sell me, or, you know, give me some of this, and the word that he uses is red stuff. Like, he doesn't even call it stew. Our translators have put that in there contextually. He just give me some of that red stuff, man. I'm really hungry. And so there was someone there who could have helped him, a brother, who persuaded him to give up the thing that he's going to live off of for the rest of his life for just a little bit of red stuff. And that's his birthright. And then, of course, when Esau makes this terrible decision, because the only people that were present were antagonistic to him, he goes through the rest of his life in pain and some substandard living compared to what he could have had, all the way up to that interaction with his brother, and then on, it seems that his family line just falls out of repute. His descendants become the Edomites, who are well known by the Israelites as being enemies and antagonistic, that from that relationship, sort of like the assassination of the Archduke, promoted so many wars between brethren. Now, here the Hebrew author tells us we should not go so far as to become an Esau. Rather, we should first pursue peace with all people. Paul will talk about that in Romans 12 as well. We can stick here in verse 14, where how can we promote peace with each other? I've seen it happen before where people think promoting peace with each other is like not talking about anything. Just like Thanksgiving. That if there's some sort of rough spot that's there between family, let's just not talk about that right now and have a good time. But that doesn't promote any growth in that family. It doesn't promote a bettering through the relationship. Promoting peace with each other might sometimes look like talking about what needs to be said. And if we do that well, with a good mind, that we're sharpening each other's thinking, we will have the fruit of peace, or rather the fruit of righteousness, which is sown in peace. He says also there in verse 14 that we need to pursue peace and also pursue sanctification or holiness. And that's a dirty word nowadays. It's been for a long time. You've heard the phrase, oh, are you holier than thou? And that's always put in a derogatory sort of way. But God demands holiness of his people. And I mean, I'm not so concerned on whether or not I'm holier than you or you're holier than me, other than I'm pursuing holiness, as was mentioned earlier by Don, so that we could even be in the presence of God, because without it, And without faith, as the Hebrew author has earlier mentioned, no one gets to see God. If you look there in verse 15 again, or rather verse 14, without which no one will see the Lord. And so holiness is expected. And just like Jacob was there, who threw Esau off track, we could be better brethren. We could be friends to one another and sharpen each other's thinking and doing to remind each other that we need to be holy people and that holiness is not only a mindset, but it's an activity in the world. As he keeps going down, he says in verse 15, and I think this is a result of the previous verse, see to it that no one comes short of the grace of God, either by not pursuing sanctification or not pursuing peace with people, not making it easier on themselves through a little bit of difficulty now. He says, see to it that no one comes short of the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springing up causes trouble. And by it, not just one person, not just that one brother who's having a hard time, but by it, many become defiled. Have you ever seen that happen? If you're in a congregation and maybe you got one issue that comes up, maybe one brother's not doing something they should, or maybe two brethren are not having the best relationship that they should between each other, and the whole congregation gets sucked down into that destruction. I've seen that happen before. He says here, we need to be careful so that not even a root pops up. I think of Barney Fife when I read that passage. You just got to nip it in the bud before anything gets started. In verse 16, he says that there be no immoral person. Verse 15, that nobody would be defiled, that nobody would sell their birthright, the place that they have as an heir of the king, for something so common or so petty as disagreements or something going on out in the world. But, you know, it's so hard when I'm in the world to think differently than that. It's why we need brethren to be good examples for each other and to sharpen our thinking as well. There's another passage in Ecclesiastes chapter 10 and verse 10, which just says in a proverb, everything that we've been talking about up to this point, it says, if the axe is dull and he does not sharpen its edge, then he must exert more strength. Wisdom has the advantage of giving success. That means do a little bit of work now. Sweat a little bit now. Be a good example and help sharpen each other's thinking and be receptive to that. And it's going to be so, so much easier. When we look at sharpening the doing, we can run one more time through this, that when our thinking is adjusted through the help of brethren in the Scripture, an example then can stimulate others to follow. And that we can be encouraged by each other's faith by seeing our joint activity. And we're not doing that, like Jesus talked about in Matthew, to be seen. We're doing it to help each other to be better tools in the hand of the Master. And that by getting to work, we'll make things easier for ourselves, even if it doesn't look like it right now. So I want to sum up the lesson in this, and then with a few quotes, which will take a little bit of time. I hope you'll bear with me. How can we use provocation? I think it's very simple, at least in a general sense, is that wise words, wisely received, can change the mind. That when you have a friend, you have friends not just because you like the same hobbies, but because a friend is going to tell you when you got something on your face. A friend is going to tell you when you're not thinking about this the right way. And so are bettered through that joint operation and communication. This is how we use provocation. We talk with each other so that we can provoke one another to do something we don't think is necessarily something I want to do right now. I don't have the energy or whatever. And then lastly, effectual examples change the motion. And so if I change my thinking through your admonition, that I see your activity, that you talk about, or rather you walk the way that you talk, then I can follow suit and will learn how to be better through that interaction with one another. Now, when I think the word provoke, again, I think of something that's prodding. I think of goads, like Jesus had mentioned, cattle prods. I can just hear the crackle now of the electricity. That's something that's not always pleasant. But I think of something that is bettered through that. And the other day, I don't know if I'd watched it before or I'd not seen it all in one sitting, but Paige made me sit down and watch Remember the Titans. And I'd not played sports at that level anyway. It was just, you know, the city league stuff with all the rest of the kids. But there's several moments, and I get it in an intellectual sense, which sounds sort of funny, but there's several moments where the team gets together and when they've rallied around each other and things are getting better, spoiler alert, they start shouting at each other. And if you don't understand the culture or anything like that, it seems kind of weird. And like, can everybody just calm down a little bit? But as they're yelling at each other, they're beating on each other's helmets and different things like that. And they're getting each other pumped up and ready to fight the fight, which is the game, the many games that they play throughout the movie. And so when I think provocation, I think of that. And sometimes it takes somebody to come over and like hit me on the helmet and go, come on, David, we got to get back in the game. There's a speech which I really enjoy. I sent it to a few of you. It came up in some conversation that we had. It's a speech from Shakespeare's Henry V. And it's been rendered into various different movies. And it is one of the greatest provocative speeches of all time, in the sense that we're using this word. It will get you. It doesn't matter what you're doing in the week. You might be like just trying to come back from your lunch break and be like, I can't do another 4 hours. This speech will get you going. It is a fantastic and well-written speech. I want to give a few verses of it to you right now. I don't know if it's going to come out in like a British accent or something. It sounds so much better in a British accent. So if you look it up, I think you'll be impressed by it. But this is a place. The people that are talking here are not in an actual place like I would have found myself, but in an example, again, like a lunch break coming back from work, or things much more serious than that, maybe things more life and death than that. I guess I'll do a little bit of background here. I'll put this up on the board in a sec. What's happening in Henry V is that they are in the middle, kind of towards the end of the Hundred Years' War, this 116-year war of England against France competing for the crown that many claimants claimed authority over both nations through all those family lines and how complicated that gets. And when Henry V invades France in a claim for the crown of France, for the authority, the rule, the throne of France, he comes in with a few people. They've conquered a few castles up to this point and have occupied those. They're getting ready to move from one castle to another and get stranded at a field near the town of Agincourt, where the French come in with 7 times the people that the British have at that point in time. Now, barring sort of the politics and who's the good guy, the bad guy of this, we'll forget some of that. But what happens at this battle, outnumbered 7-1, against armored knights on horses versus archers and men-at-arms, which do not have as much armor, they win. And you'd think, how do you win against those odds? Even the Bible says if you're going to odds against 2-1, you might want to think about whether or not you can win that fight. And Henry V apparently thought he could. But in Shakespeare's rendition of this, he gives a speech which has to rouse everyone, to provoke and to stimulate everyone to action, because what is about to follow this speech is life and death, and they could all be completely and totally wiped out, and the King of England would be lost. Here's how the speech goes, at least at the beginning of this scene. King Henry V's cousin, Westmoreland, gives this phrase, and I've uttered phrases like this. I've been discouraged in ways like this, and maybe you have. He looks at the battle as it's about ready to be fought. He sees them outnumbered, and he says, "Oh, that we now had here but 1/10,000 of those men in England that do no work this day." In other words, we don't have enough to do this. And if we had just one more of those lazy people back there on the couch in England, we could have fixed this. Westmoreland's thinking is off. Maybe it would have helped, but he's going to lose the battle that way. At this point in time, Henry comes back into the scene. And he overhears Westmoreland, who says this, not thinking that Henry was nearby. And he says, and I'm abbreviating some of this for time's sake, "God's will, I pray thee, wish not one man more. Rather proclaim it, Westmoreland, through my host, that he which has no stomach to this fight, let him depart. His passport shall be made, and crowns for convoy put into his purse. We would not die in that man's company that fears his fellowship to die with us." As he continues on, he describes some elements of the day that they're fighting on. It was called St. Crispin's Day. It was a holiday revering a Christian, at least a name that had lived some time previously to that. And he describes how when we go home, and if we outlive this, everybody's going to respect us. They're going to remember us for forever. We're going to be able to stand a tiptoe when that day is named and say, "I fought there with King Henry on St. Crispin's Day." As he continues, and here's where the line gets maybe a little bit more appropriate for our lesson. He says, "Old men forget, yet all shall be forgot. But we in it will be remembered. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers. For he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother, be he ne'er so vile. This day shall gentle his condition. And gentlemen in England now abed shall think themselves accursed that they were not here, and hold their manhoods cheap, while any speaks that fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day." And at this point, the crowd gets up on their feet and they grab their weapons and they cheer and they're ready to go to the fight. And that, it really is an exciting speech. But this isn't the end of it, at least from my favorite part. Because right at this point in time, they get ready to go into the difficulty. And a herald from the French lines comes to demand surrender. I mean, it seems inevitable. And here's how he puts it. Or rather, I'll read it to you before we read that here. The herald comes in, and let's see here, where is it? Nope, I think I've lost it. Anyway, he comes in and he says, you know what, I've come here to demand your surrender before your most assured overthrow. And here's where a person enters, having seen the battle lines, and he comes to his king and he says, my sovereign lord, bestow yourself with speed. The French are bravely in their battle set and will with all expedience march upon us. And so the French herald has just said, surrender or die. And one of his own people comes in and says, the battle is too difficult to fight. And here's where Henry's blood starts to boil. And here's where the battle gets ready to be fought. He says, all things are ready if our minds be so. And he sends the herald off back to his masters, telling them that if they want to win and if they want ransom for surrender, they can have my bones when I have leave of them, which is like so cool. And then King Henry says, all things are ready if our minds be so. Now, the cousin at the beginning who said, we can't win this. If only we had just 10,000 more people here, we could maybe survive. He jumps in and he says, perish the man whose mind is backward now. And the king says, thou dost not wish for more help from cousin or from England, cousin? He says, God's will, my liege, would you and I alone, without more help, could fight this royal battle. At this point in time, the mind has been sharpened, and they're ready to go to action. And even when the time has come, the decisive moment to give up and to surrender and to have no pain at all, to go back home to England and everything could be taken care of, they get ready to fight. At this point in time, oh, here it is. Mountjoy, that's not pronounced correct, I'm sure. The herald comes in. Once more I come to know of thee, King Harry, if for thy ransom thou wilt now compound before thy most assured overthrow. I pray thee, bear my former answer back. Bid them achieve me and sell my bones. My lord, comes another person, another Englishman, after the herald leaves. He says, my lord, most humbly on my knee, I beg the leading of the Vollard, which is the initial charge, it's the vanguard. He wants to be the tip of the spear, the most certain suicidal job in this whole fight. And he comes and he begs the king for a spot in the fight. He doesn't want to be left on the sidelines. His mind and actions have been changed and sharpened too. Here's how the speech ends. King Henry replies with, take it, my brave York. Now, soldiers, march away. And how thou pleasest God, dispose of the day. That, at least the scene that I had seen, is said so quietly and so soberly. It, to me, is the more affecting line in this whole speech, in that it is time to go to war. It's time to fight. Turning back, surrender, is a loss of life and limb and property. To go back to the old ways that I used to live, the old gods, my old desires, my old lusts, all the old ways that I used to think of things, is suicide. It's the real suicide. But if we would go forward and be provoked like this speech was, like that football speech is, like every time a friend comes to you and says, let's get up and strengthen your knees and strengthen your hands, we're going to the fight, that we would be useful tools in the hands of the master. I want to finish up with one passage this morning. It comes from Hebrews. If you don't like that, if you don't like Shakespeare, I don't blame you. I hated Shakespeare for forever. That, I think, changed my mind. But Hebrews chapter 10 is the Hebrew author's, I think, closing pre-battle speech. And unfortunately, it gets abused sometimes to make points smaller than itself, which might be found here, certainly, but there's a greater point to be found. The Hebrew author says, let us now hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering. For he who promised is faithful. And let us consider how to stimulate, or provoke, your translation might say, one another to love and good deeds, not forsaking our own assembling together, as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day drawing near. Every day we live, every step that we take in this world, we are walking through a battlefield. And brethren, it does no good thinking, oh, if we had just one more of the lazy brethren that are here that can't be involved in anything like that. That's not going to get us anywhere. Rather, if we are committed to the confession that Jesus is King, and I'll follow Him anywhere, and that I can, as a servant of His, help other people, help brethren who are having a hard time, consider, think about regularly how to poke and prod them so that they can be in the fight too, then I'll have done my job, and I'll have been that blade forged with iron, useful in the hands of the Master. Consider how to provoke one another to love and good deeds, because as iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens the countenance of his friend. The invitation this morning is a question. What would it take you to get you moving? What would it take you to get up off the pew, to move through a difficult circumstance in your life, which maybe has come about at no fault of your own? What would it take to get you up, to get you to bend, to get you to be honed as a blade, useful for the fight? Would it take a gentle nudge? I hope we would be prepared enough to just be gently pushed in the direction we need to go. But maybe it takes a hammer blow also, that if we'll be willing to be softened, to be moved, to be stimulated to other good deeds and to love, then we can be, again, useful tools in the hand of the Master. If you'd like to become that this morning, if you'd like to enter into His service, to go into the fight with Him, He calls everybody who would love to have a fellowship with Him to die like He's died for our sins so that we could become a new creation through Him as He lives forever to this day. If you'd like to do that this morning, let us know as we stand and sing together.